Well, here in Boston, about 2,000 people packed an interfaith service honoring the 3 people killed and 170 injured at the Boston Marathon Monday. President and First Lady Obama attended the services today at the Cathedral of the Holy Cross, where the president spoke. As for the investigation, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano says the FBI wants to speak with individuals seen in at least one video from the Boston Marathon, but she says she isn't yet calling them suspects. Now, yesterday there was a flurry of media reports, CNN citing sources that said surveillance footage from the Lord & Taylor store at the finish line showed a man dropping off a bag at the site of the second explosion and then walking away. It's one of thousands of images investigators are now combing through, and they're not alone. Scores of amateur detectives are looking at photos and videos and coming up with their own theories. The social media site Reddit has a forum called Find Boston Bombers. People are singling out the guy in the blue robe, or circling black backpacks, or anything they consider suspicious. How are investigations being done in an age of crowdsourcing for clues, and does that help or hurt? Hanifa Reed is a professor of computer science at Dartmouth College, an expert in digital image analysis and forensics. I want to spend a few minutes with him today. And Hani, what are you seeing on these social media sites? Start there.
Yeah, so we're seeing a somewhat predictable response, which is when there's a tragedy of this magnitude, people want to help. And that's a testament, I think, to the spirit of this country in many ways. And I think, you know, unlike, say, 10 years ago, there's a massive amount of information and data and images and videos out there that a small number of people simply can't go through. And in general, more eyes is usually means better analysis. I think it's a mixed bag in this case. I think while certainly many of the analysis and the eyes and the looking at the images and the videos that have been coming out of Boston have been informative, there are, of course, you know, many things that are just being said that are wrong. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those wrong analyses can also be dangerous. If we start making conclusions about it was a dark person who did it, it was this person, and that person lives over here, and suddenly we have a vigilante mentality. So I like the idea that the crowd provides law enforcement with a massive amount of data for them to do the analysis, but I'm not sure that that analysis belongs in the hands of the crowd right now. I think it probably still belongs primarily in the hands of law enforcement.
Yeah, but that horse has left that barn. We want to talk to you more about that, but when you say, you know, things can be wrong, we just want to touch on some of the reporting of the mainstream media yesterday, and it's sort of emblematic of what happens when everything is so sped up by technology. You know, after the reports of the Lord & Taylor video, which turned out to be true, there were several media outlets, CNN, the Associated Press, the Boston Globe, WCVB-TV, our own home station, WBUR, with good reporters who said sources told them there had also been an arrest. Now, these are terrific reporters. These are not desk jockeys. I have sympathy, not Schadenfreude, you know, gloating, but because those arrest reports all had to be pulled back. But I guess the question is, you know, is this one of the things that officials have to deal with? Yes, they may have a picture or they may have a video, but with so many pictures and so many videos out there, how many do they tell the press about? How many do they show the public to get the help that you could traditionally get from the public without maybe also jeopardizing their investigations? I mean, have you seen this kind of all this information coming in at once from surveillance cameras, et cetera, actually jeopardize investigations?
I think it's a great point, Robin, and it's a bit of a double-edged sword. We want the help of the public because they can do things by virtue of giving us access to images and videos. And yet, we can see even when the professionals are working, they get it wrong. And there's a price to be paid for getting it wrong. It is a distraction, right? It takes away from the efforts that are being that need to be focused on other places. So I think there's a price to be paid when we bring the public into this mix. And then the question is, how do you balance the needs of, look, we need all the images, the videos, we need help. We need help finding this person from, we don't want false reports being spread. So the problem is that false reports are now spread not just through CNN, the AP, but it's now Twitter and Facebook. And it is viral and it is fast and it's furious. And of course, the news feeds off of the Twitter and the Facebook and that feeds again. And so it creates this vicious cycle. And I think false reporting is obviously bad for journalism, but I think it's bad in these cases, too, because they're distractions from very precious time.
Well, and yet, Mark Fenster, a University of Florida law professor, is quoted in today's Boston Globe pointing out that this idea of having the public's help isn't new. After the JFK assassination,
yeah,
ordinary civilians were poured through their photographs and they turned up clues.
It's true. This is not a new thing. It's sort of more public now because of the nature of the internet. And also there's a big difference between now and the 1960s, which is everybody has a camera. So back
and it's
in
your
the,
phone.
It's
a lot
your
of the
phone,
time.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very powerful in some ways, right? So we now have the ability to not only take images and videos at an unprecedented volume, but also to disseminate it at an unprecedented speed and accessibility. But you're absolutely right. The public has gotten involved in these things, you know, throughout history in analyzing. People are still debating the authenticity of the JFK's Zapruder film, the Oswald photo, the moon landing images, the September 11th attack, the Newton shooting. So that this is not something new, but I think the volume and the speed at which it is happening is something new.
Well, I'm also thinking of the safety of the people involved. Reports yesterday were that there was a man with a backwards baseball cap that might be a person of interest. Well, now there are pictures of a man in a backwards baseball cap all over the internet from Monday. Major broadcast outlets are not showing it, but this could potentially be dangerous for an innocent person. A lot of people wear their baseball caps backwards in Boston.
It is dangerous, and there are precedents for this. This has happened before where tragic events happen. We rush to implicate somebody. It turns out to be the wrong person, and their personal safety, their reputation, their family is at stake. And I think that also is why we need to be very careful on how we treat the information coming out of online sources like Reddit and other places. I think it's we have to be very careful about the quality of that information.
Well, let's do that when we come back. Hani Farid, professor of computer science at Dartmouth. We'll talk about the technology that's being used. Take a few seconds here to listen to the Boston Children's Chorus singing Up to the Mountain at today's memorial service here in Boston. Back with more with Professor Farid in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about investigations in the age of crowdsourcing for clues. We're talking with Hani Farid. He's a professor of computer science at Dartmouth College, also founder of 4N6 Technologies. They're a photo authentication company. One of the technologies we want to talk about with you, Professor Farid, we know investigators have television videos, surveillance videos, and all these pictures that people have sent in that they have personally taken. You say there are four main ways these images are parsed. Start with facial recognition and detection software.
Right. So most people who have a smartphone or a modern-day digital camera will know that when they point their camera at a person, faces will often be localized for you. Put a small square around that.
Yeah.
And there's one of two things is happening. So there's face detection, which is simply find for me in the image a face. And there's very nice computer software, computer algorithms that now are very effective at that because faces have very specific patterns that are distinct from the rest of the scene. And so, for example, if I give you 10,000 images, we are very good at finding the location of all the faces in those images. That can be, of course, very useful when you're trying to very quickly analyze tens of thousands, 100,000 of images to just ask, is there a person in here?
Yeah.
Now, we can even go one step further. Not only can we detect faces, but we can start to recognize people. So you could, for example, give me an image, and there's a person of interest in there. You highlight their face, and you say, find me all the faces that look like this one automatically. And the technology for that is very sophisticated and is now commercially available and very effective.
Wow. Okay, so there's that. Then there's pattern recognition software. Different from face recognition, this might, recognize a logo on a knapsack?
That's exactly right. So faces are nice because they're quite distinct, and we sort of know how to model those mathematically inside the computer. But we can also sort of take the same basic concepts that we use that are developed specifically for faces and do sort of generic, if you will, pattern recognition. So, for example, an investigator may see a logo on a knapsack and the person's face is turned away from you and say, I want all images where I can see that logo. And the computer software can very relatively quickly go through hundreds of thousands, millions of images looking for that specific pattern. And the power of this is that the pattern can be altered a little bit. The lighting may be different. You may view it from a slightly different angle. It may be rotated a little bit. It may be partially occluded. And we can still find fairly consistently those types of patterns and create links across a large collection of images.
Yeah. What's amazing is that there are now ways to kind of put a time-space map of a scene. You can scroll through it almost second by second. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so one of the great things about most cameras now being in smartphones is they are what are called geotagged. So most smartphones will store inside of the image some information that tells you the GPS location, which of course it gets from triangulating from the cell towers, and the time of day. And unlike your camera, the time of day is probably correct because that's coming from the cell phone as opposed to having to be programmed by you. And that means every photo has associated with it a timestamp and a GPS or a geolocation stamp. And so what that means is that if people provide for you hundreds of thousands to millions of images from one event, you can effectively lay these images out in space and time across a map and say, okay, these images happen at this place in this five-second window. Okay, next five-second window, this place over here, these images. And so you can imagine just creating these towers of images in space and time and start to piece together the events very nicely, in fact.
It's almost like taking pictures. We feel like we've seen this in advertising, for instance, when there's an ad that has 1,000 faces and they make it into one face.
Right.
It's almost like creating video out of still.
Absolutely. And in fact, you can even go further than that. There's very nice technology that allows you to take multiple images taken from different vantage points and reconstruct a three-dimensional model of what was being seen there from many, many different two-dimensional images. And that means you can now have a virtual reconstruction of a scene, which is, of course, incredibly powerful because you can spin it around, you can look at it from different angles, and suddenly you have real power from that crowd of images.
Okay, but Professor, we also live in an age of Photoshop. So how do investigators know? They're asking people to send in, they're getting thousands of images. How do they know they haven't been tampered with?
Right, and we've seen this before in these types of events. People either intentionally or unintentionally provide altered images where either the time has been altered, the GPS has been altered, somebody has been spliced into the image, something has been removed from the image. And so a lot of technology has been developed that can determine whether images have come directly off of a smartphone or a camera. And it uses a very specific signature on the way the digital image is actually bundled up by a particular make and model of a camera. And when those get touched by something like Photoshop, it alters that signature or that fingerprint, and then we can determine that it's not authentic. And so what investigators can do is say, we've got a million images, maybe a fraction of them have been altered. Let's just kick them out right away and make sure that we keep our evidence intact and pure and accurate.
Well, this idea of authentication came into play after the hockey riots last year in Vancouver, because people were using all these pictures that had been posted, but there were fake images there.
Yeah, that was a really interesting example of where there were, of course, many, many real images, but people either intentionally or unintentionally were creating doctored photographs to make it harder for police investigators to figure out who was doing what where. And suddenly you have a real problem that we're trying to conduct a fairly serious legal investigation, and we can't have in the mix, even if it's a small percentage of it, we can't have in the mix data or information that is simply false. It's bad for the investigation, it's time-consuming because it leads to incorrect leads, and it potentially implicates somebody who had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
And again, we get back to that issue of, you know, it's great to rely on the crowd because they have information we don't have, but of course we have to take that step very, very cautiously.
Well, and you're saying maybe let them help by producing the photographs, but you've come down on the side against this idea of crowdsourcing for clues online. Leave it to the professionals.
I think that is where I fall right now. I think the crowd has some real wisdom, but I think it also has a lot of noise and a lot of inaccuracies. And I think to find that balance, we don't know how to do that now. So let's leave it to the pros.
Hani Farid, a professor of computer science at Dartmouth College, thanks so much for weighing in on what, in all probability, investigators are doing right now. Professor Farid, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Quick break. We'll be right back with the latest news here and now.